Boy, sometimes it sure feels like that, doesn't it?
Hey, call to order the House Committee on Education for May 21st already, 2015. Okay, we have a busy schedule today. We've got an informational meeting and there's some public hearings and work sessions. So welcome to the House Committee on Ed. Welcome the pages here. We're running out of pages very soon. We won't have them in the building. We appreciate what you all do.
Want me to fix that?
Pardon?
Want me to fix that? Get more pages?
I think we're closing it down. So anyway, with that, I will open up an informational hearing on Senate Bill 214 update. And we're having updates just because these were a lot of the OEIB bills that may not come to our committee, but we want you guys to be able to know about them. So with that, I'd like to call up Rob Saxon, Dan Goldman, Karen Twain, and Mark Lanseth. Which every single one of them has a Tigard connection. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Richard, is there anything we're reading on this one on 214?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, this is the H3 to grade 3 bill.
This is what?
The H3 to grade 3 bill.
Great. 3 to 3. Okay.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, joined by the panel here today, introduced by Chair Doherty, and so I won't do that again. And I'll try to keep my comments fairly brief this morning. In support, I wanted to speak about Senate Bill 214 and talk a little bit about strategic initiatives. As you know, this was some work that Senate Bill 214 is a result of some work that the department had done over the past year around a possible strategic initiative on age 3 to grade 3 literacy. And just real briefly, I want to talk about the strategic initiatives in general and get more specific about this particular topic. We approached the strategic initiatives really in three different ways. One of those was large initiatives that would go across the state and would really reach out and impact all parts of the state. And a couple of examples of that would be the work that we did out of over the last couple of years with the Common Core State Standards or educator effectiveness, where really every single educator in the state was impacted by that strategic initiative. And it's the kind of work that needs to be done broadly in order to scale up something that's really large that needs to be accomplished. The second kind of strategic initiative I would call a scale up of success. So an example of that might be the collaboration grants or the mentoring grant or the Eastern Promise grant, where we had something happening in a place that was highly successful that we then took and tried to replicate in multiple places across the state, and then we would have some ongoing replication of. And then lastly would be really what would be a small demonstration site, where we knew that there was some work that could make a difference for students and that we wanted to implement in a place and see if down the road it might be something that was highly successful that then could be scaled up in a different way. An example of that might be the student mentoring and acceleration grants. So those are some of the ways that we approach these. And as we talked about the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative, we really looked at it as a really big initiative, one of the very first kinds that I just described, something that would impact all educators across the state. And part of our rationale there simply was that we recognized that with some of the focus and priority work that we were doing in the state, we were having great success. And the percentage of students who were reading at grade level at third grade was increasing significantly in those districts or in those schools. But even if we had wild success in all 90 schools that we were supporting, and we moved them from an average of about 55% of students meeting or exceeding to 90% of students meeting or exceeding on third grade reading, that the difference statewide would only be an increase of about 2%, because such a small number of students overall, when you look at the large population of the state, would actually be impacted. That's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to see Oregon have 90 to 95% of all third graders reading at grade level by the end of third grade. And if you're going to do that, you basically have to have it be a large initiative, reach out and touch everyone, and it becomes very expensive to do and probably too expensive for us to be able to move forward as we're working through the session. And I recognize that, but I do think it's important for people to understand the concepts and also think about the other kind of initiatives that we did, scale up and small demonstration sites. The literacy initiative did something that really used a number of different components. So when you think about literacy, it isn't a single thing. It's multiple pieces of work that need to be done at a really high and effective level in order to work. There's a great book out now by a author, a researcher named John Hattie called Visible Learning. John Hattie basically has said almost anything that you do educationally will work. It just is what's most effective. And he's taken large research projects and looked at multiple of the same thing and made some determination about what works best. Not that it works, but that it works best. It's the highest ROI. So we looked at that research and tried to make some suggestions that would follow that research based on best return on investment around literacy. The other thing that we did is looked at districts across the state and some of the districts that were having success. So there are some districts who have wonderful community partnerships, and we're seeing their student outcomes improve, like David Douglas. Or we see some that are highly instructionally focused. They're working very diligently on what instruction looks like in the classroom. A couple of examples of that would be the Tigard-Tualatin School District or the Bend School District. And they are exceeding, their results are exceeding the results of districts with students whose demographics look like theirs. Districts that have done great work around extended time, like the Bethel School District offering summer school to students who need it, and their outcomes and the improvement that they're seeing there. And then also standards alignment, and districts who are saying we need to make sure that the instructional and behavioral standards between early learning world and the K-12 world align, and that we're thoughtful about those standards all the way from really age 3 to grade 3, mm-hmm. like the McMinnville School District. And honestly, if I was going to choose a district that has implemented the majority of those components, it would be the McMinnville School District. Mm-hmm. And that really all of those things are necessary if you're going to get to 90 to 95%. So there are two parts to this: cover broadly and deeply. It's both of those. And it really is all the components that it takes to make that happen. I do think that the idea of demonstration sites is a possibility to prove up that this is a methodology that would make a vast difference for students in districts. We would not see the kind of 90 to 95% across the state, but we could see it in some locations and then think about future sessions. With that, I'll turn it over to Karen Twain, and thank you for your time, unless there are some questions.
Okay, thank you. Karen?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dougherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Twain. I'm the Director of Literacy for the Oregon Department of Education. Previously, I've been a teacher, counselor, and administrator in the Tigard-Tualatin School District. I'm here to testify in favor, of course, of this Senate bill, as amended, the 3-to-3 Literacy Initiative. As an educator for more than 30 years, this is the first time I have seen a plan that covers all the parts of a comprehensive literacy program. When I was principal of Metzger Elementary, a highly diverse school, we used two parts of the initiative to improve the achievement and learning of our students that were highly effective. One was full-day kindergarten, and the other was effective research-based methodologies that included strong and consistent core instruction and multi-tiered support systems. In doing so, we literally closed the achievement gap, and we were recognized for 5 years straight by the state. As the population in Oregon changes to be more diverse, I've come to realize that it will take much more for us to get all of our children in the state to be able to read by third grade. As you know, reading by third grade is a major milestone in a child's career because it opens up all the pathways to future success. In order for this to happen, we will also need extra time to learn for the students who have struggled the most in the form of summer and after-school programs. By engaging community-based organizations in this effort, we up the ante for parent engagement as we work together to bring in students and their families. Another exciting part to the 3-to-3 Literacy Initiative is that it spans from age 3 to grade 3 or to 8-year-olds. While there are pockets of collaboration throughout the state between early learning and K-12 system, this is the first time that we have laid out a plan in a qualitative way that ties the two together. We know this is the right thing to do because we have seen it work in many other states and to certain parts of Oregon. In fact, we were one of the 4 states in the nation that was chosen to work with the National Governors Association on a 3-to-3 plan. And we did that this past fall. This collaboration comes to you in the form of Senate Bill 214. By having shared professional development, aligning of the academic and social emotional standards, and working on the transition from the early years to the early grades, we know we can better change the path for many of our children. I've had the privilege over the last year and a half to talk to school districts that are striving towards and have had some success in having their students reach the third grade benchmark in the state. Superintendents, teachers, community-based organizations, and early learning partners support this plan because they know it will make a difference. Last year, we had 68% of our students reading by third grade in the state of Oregon. You can do the math and realize that we have 32% that couldn't. And mostly, those struggling students were students of color and those living in poverty. This is unacceptable. I have felt all along that it's a moral imperative to get this done. What it means for all of us is that more children are in interventions too late and being identified to go into special education, which is a huge cost to our state. It also pushes us further from raising graduation rates and reaching our 40-40-20 goal. The only way to change this is to do something significantly different, and I really want to accentuate those words. That is what the 3-to-3 literacy initiative does, and I highly encourage you to pass and fund Senate Bill 214. It's the right thing to do for our kids and will change the economic and social face of Oregon forever. Thank you. I'd like to pass the baton to Mark.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. As Chair Doherty said, my name is Mark Langseth, and I am president and CEO of I Have a Dream Oregon. Our mission is to empower students from low-income communities to thrive in school, college, and career. We were actually founded in Oregon in 1990, so this year marks a quarter century of doubling or even tripling high school graduation and college participation rates for our low-income student dreamers. Sandwiched between two people that are going to talk mostly about early literacy, I want to make a few comments around the broader area of school community collaboration. Just under 2 years ago, the Oregon legislature was lauded all over the country for forging a grand bargain on your biennial budget. I want to suggest to you today that nothing short of another grand bargain, this time between schools and communities, is required if we're going to change the trajectory for low-income kids throughout our great state. I believe that robust discussion about Senate Bill 214 is one important step toward that end, and I'm pleased to be part of this process. At I Have a Dream Oregon, we believe that this new grand bargain between schools and communities must have three fundamental elements. One, redefinition of the P-12 education system to encompass both schools and communities. Two, much clearer roles for schools and communities within this expanded system. And three, a great degree of intentionality about how schools and communities are funded under this expanded system to collaborate. Regarding redefinition of the P-12 system to encompass both communities and schools, we as a state and nation have been strong on rhetoric around it takes a village. But this rhetoric has not translated into long-term, comprehensive, sustainable local models where schools and communities are working in highly strategic ways and where outcomes for our lowest income kids are improving. Regarding clearer roles for schools and communities, both in dialogue and in practice, we've mostly defaulted to asking schools to bear virtually all responsibility, both for delivering academic results and for addressing poverty-related student and family barriers, regardless of how large those poverty-related barriers loom. In this new grand bargain, we suggest that communities must take primary responsibility for lowering these student and family poverty-related barriers and allow schools to more fully focus on teacher effectiveness and classroom outcomes. Let me offer a quick local example from the Rockwood neighborhood in East Portland of how this grand bargain might work on the ground. Based at Alder Elementary School, where over 95% of the students are eligible for free and reduced lunch, I Have a Dream, along with the Reynolds School District, is helping lead an innovative school community demonstration project that now has over 70 community partners working together to help lower poverty-related student and family barriers. Examples of these partnerships include a family stability and housing effort that is a partnership between Home Forward and Human Solutions, collaboration with multiple mentoring organizations to provide over 350 kids with adult role models, major intervention in early reading with organizations like SMART and the Children's Book Bank, and in fall 2015, the launch of a no-fee Montessori preschool classroom at Alder. Plus, dozens of other organizations providing coordinated after-school and summer programming. Each grade level is also adopted by a local college and university partner, including annual half-day and full-day campus visits each year to their adoptive college or university. Think about that. If you're at Alder Elementary for 6 years, K through five, you will have visited six college campuses before you enter sixth grade. The idea behind this model is that we as a community can do a much better job of leveraging and aligning our resources, community resources, higher ed resources, and can do a much better job of working in more strategic ways with schools to achieve results. And though still early in its implementation, we now have three pieces of evidence that this demonstration project at Alder is getting results. Alder Elementary, even with four principal transitions in the last 4 years, is the fastest improving elementary school in the Reynolds School District. Reading proficiency rates at Alder have doubled in the last 2 years, and math proficiency rates have tripled. Finally, our family stability and housing supports also seem to be working, with an 80% increase in year-over-year retention rates for Alder students transitioning from Alder's feeder middle schools to Reynolds High School. Finally, a couple quick comments about how we might fund this new system of schools and communities working together in the kind of highly integrated strategic partnerships like those based at Alder Elementary. Interestingly, I think the path that SB 214 has taken during this session is telling. That is, in a state where funding for schools is very near the bottom nationally, it makes sense to me that Oregon education leaders are first and foremost committed to retaining current and growing new funding for schools. Our operating assumption at I Have a Dream Oregon is that the vast majority of school leaders, teachers, staff, administrators are capable of excellence, but in our experience working with schools which have at least 80% poverty rates, family and student barriers related to poverty simply overwhelm most teachers and most schools' capacity to deliver strong educational results. Again, we believe that lowering these barriers, these poverty-related barriers, should be the primary responsibility of communities, not schools, and finding creative ways to fund this new grand bargain between communities and schools without undermining funding for schools is obviously a key challenge. I look forward to continuing that discussion with you in the future. Thank you, and happy to take questions.
Okay. If there's no questions for these amazing individuals that I get to testify with, then I will...
Well, and actually, you can even relax and have 12 inches between you and the microphone.
And not scream into the microphone
yeah.
at you?
I don't.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 214 and the proposed 3-3 literacy initiative with its amendment, the current amendment. I'm Dan Goldman, and I'm the superintendent of schools in Hood River County School District. And I have been there for 2 years before being in Hood River. As Chair Doherty knows, I was in Tiger-Tualatin School District, where I was the assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction. And in Tiger-Tualatin, as the chair knows, our students far outperform students throughout the state on every state assessment at every grade level. And it's a district where the National Center on Education Outcomes named Tiger-Tualatin one of the 10 most effective school districts in the nation in terms of student literacy and other academic outcomes. Within a 5-year span, educators in the Tiger-Tualatin schools closed the racial achievement gap in reading outcomes by 36%, far outperforming state averages despite having a similar percentage of students living in poverty and far more students of color. On measures of college readiness, such as the ACT, low-income students from Tiger-Tualatin far surpassed state averages, where the primary district-wide strategy wasn't project-based learning or proficiency-based teaching. It wasn't STEM. It wasn't CTE. It was ensuring that every single elementary student was a proficient reader, and that was really the district focus. Why the singular focus? So the research is clear about the importance of getting students to read by the end of their primary years in school. And the resource drain on education and human services and public safety budgets that occurs when youngsters miss this important milestone. So here's some research snippets, and hopefully your eyes don't roll to the back of your head as I do a little bit of research dance on you. But in 2004, a very famed educational researcher, Joe Torgerson, established through a massive national study that poor readers in fourth grade struggled in literacy in kindergarten. And why this was important is because if we put systems in place where we identify kids who are struggling in kindergarten, maybe they won't be struggling in fourth grade. So we know who these kids are if we take a look, and we systematically take a look at who these children are. He also found that children who struggle to read in K-3 rarely achieve average reading skills. So if you are a below proficient reader by the end of your third grade year, the chance of you catching up is very slim, and the resources necessary to help you catch up are unbelievably large. In 2011, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP, established that children who aren't reading proficiently by fourth grade are four times more likely to drop out of school. So this is all coming together, right? Like, if you can't read by the end of third grade, you're in big, big trouble. Four times more likely to drop out of high school. According to the National Center for Educational Statistics, in 2008, fewer than 45%, or about half of those students who drop out of high school, were employed. Half. So if you can't read by the end of third grade, your likely outcome of being unemployed is very, very, is highly increased. We also know that adaptive functioning as an adult is highly dependent upon academic success or failure. And that's just kind of like something we take for granted. But there is a lot of research around if you are highly successful in school, you also have a very high chance of being highly successful in life. So this research should shock us. It should compel us to improve the reading outcomes for our youngest learners. If academic success or failure is so dependent on reading proficiency by third grade and a precursor to adaptive functioning and economic and social independence as adults, then we need to get serious about investing in early literacy. Last year, as Karen Twain just said, last year only 68% of Oregon third graders were proficient readers on the state assessment. This means 32% of our state's youngest students require significant intervention and investment in fourth grade. We also know from research I just cited that they will likely need specially designed interventions throughout their entire academic career. A huge portion of K-12 budgets are spent intervening with struggling readers because we know a student cannot make it in school or in this world without being able to read. Resources spent on intervening with students in middle and high school are funds not spent on CTE. They're funds not spent on STEM. They're funds not spent on expanding IB or AP courses or any number of innovations that our community members and post-secondary institutions demand of us in Oregon. It's a huge resource drain, and if we don't do something radically different around literacy development to change the reading outcomes for elementary age students, you can be guaranteed, because it's borne out in study after study, that our human services and public safety budgets will continue to require the lion's share of additional state funding, as scores of illiterate our Oregonians cannot find family wage jobs. And that is what we're finding right now in our budget, I believe. The substantive programming elements in SB 214 were not pulled out of thin air. Here's what the Institute of Educational Sciences, or the research arm at the U.S. Department of Education, says must be prevalent in an early reading program. First of all, you need school-wide consistent screening assessments. You've got to find the kids. You need protected time for differentiated instruction with research-based material. These are also both things that are called for in SB 214. Instruction must be sufficiently intensive and focus on critical elements of reading, which I won't bore you with today. And research-based interventions for struggling students must be intensive and systematic, also things called for in SB 214. There must be frequent and consistent progress monitoring for struggling readers, also called for in SB 214. And there must be additional time beyond the core reading time to learn and practice necessary literacy skills. Those are the critical components of SB 214. They're the components that we know at the federal level from our major research arm in the United States for education are known to move the dial. They're the same things that move the dial for Oregonians right here in different in certain districts. Oregon must invest in these strategies that work and stop believing that all Oregon youth will suddenly learn how to read by the end of third grade just because we measure it and just because we report it in the newspapers. Without significant investment in effective research-based early literacy programs and significant investment in partnerships with community organizations like I Have a Dream and others, whose mission includes reducing the social and economic barriers to adaptive functioning, we cannot expect different results. Just because we're measuring it will not get us different results. I applaud the 3-to-3 reading initiative because it's in line with research and what we know works right here in Oregon in highly diverse districts like David Douglas, Tigard Tualatin, Bethel, McMinnville, and others. With human services and public safety budgets increasing at a much greater clip than the state education budgets over the last 12 years, and with strategies for increasing state revenue highly unlikely in the short term, there is no more important investment than in early literacy for the state of Oregon. Absolutely none. The elements in the 3-to-3 reading initiative, as written in SB 214, are research-based, they're proven to work, and will make an enormous long-term educational and economic impact for the state of Oregon, and it must be funded. As a superintendent who has to make difficult and sometimes unpopular financial decisions with scarce resources, I'm deeply empathetic to the competing influences of your fiscal decisions. And I want to thank you sincerely for your time and service to the people of Oregon. So thank you for that.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions to this panel? Representative Wilson.
I do. To Mr. Goldman, thank you for the testimony today. I appreciate that. With Oregon's graduation rate being what it is and our dropout rate there and also other issues that we have like absenteeism and so forth, it's easy sometimes to think that in Oregon we're kind of throwing a bunch of stuff against the wall and see what sticks. But this seems a little different than that. I like the sounds of what you're talking about. It just seems to make sense to me. You know, I come out of private business, and sometimes when you are wondering why something might not be working for your business, you look at somebody's business where it is working, and you ask, what are they doing that we're not doing? I guess my question would be, in that I do like what you're saying here, are other states doing this kind of thing too? Have other states realized that this is an antidote to their problems?
So there are other states that have taken a much more targeted focus on early literacy development. And these two esteemed colleagues would know the exact states. I know a few. So Florida is a really good example. Florida invested in a system, I'm going to really bore you now, a system called response to intervention, which has embedded in its system all these elements that are in SB 214. Mm-hmm. They're the same elements that are embedded in the Tigard-Tualatin School District, which I just talked a bunch about, the successes there. As a state, they have a really massive program to implement RTI, or response to intervention, across the state, and they fund it. And so they are getting far different outcomes than the state of Oregon, as you mentioned, graduation rates. And they're a far more diverse state as well, both economically and racially. And so that's an example of a state. Iowa is another great example of a state that I know of that has taken these core principles and legislated them. And they are getting significantly different results as well. And I don't know if you all want to add to that.
He's spot on, and there's a number of other states. I mentioned the National Governors Association and that we had worked with them as well as some other bodies, and that was the whole point, was to take a look at the nation, see what's working, and put this together. So we've taken the best of all and tried to make it into a package, realizing that this is a lot of work, but it's the only way things are going to change. There are some states, different places that have had good results with parts of it, and this is one of the most comprehensive plans, I'm told, in the nation.
No, thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you. I'd like to have longer conversations with you about a number of things here, but I am, because I wrote some of these code words, I get concerned about when I hear them. And so the outcomes and a number of other educational code words sort of jump out at me as soon as I hear that. What are you doing? Don't tell me how you're trying to collaborate. What in a classroom, what is different for the students there? Not what we can write about in an academic forum or even a political forum. Mm-hmm. But what are you doing? What makes it different? And more importantly for me, quite frankly, is I am not as tied to, as many people here will tell you, the test scores or on things. I want to know whether kids like to read.
Sure.
And not just whether they're coming in so that they can learn to read. We talk about a lot of the dropout issues. My contention is very simple. We are getting lots of dropouts because kids have no reason to come to school. So what are we reading? What are we doing to actually encourage children to read? Not just decoding the words, not just acting comprehensive, but what is actually happening there?
I can speak from my own school district and also from my experience in Tigard-Tualatin and also in Portland Public Schools where I was a teacher. So what happens in a system that I'm promoting and that is, I believe, is written in SB 214, what's different is a number of things. So when I started in Portland Public Schools as a teacher, we didn't have a core reading program. So
when was this?
That's a good question now. 1998, 99.
That's curious. When I taught in Portland Public Schools in 74, we had a core reading program. So
I'm happy that you had it.
And we're going to have to,
but we'll talk later on.
We're going to have to keep going on this. Thank you.
So what's different is, like in Tigard and now in Hood River School District, we have a research-based core program that's taught in every classroom that's connected to the state standards. That's a really different animal than the core program from before that time, because those programs didn't exist that were connected to these high-leverage standards. So the first thing that you have is you actually have materials that are vetted, they're research-based, they're tried before they're adopted, and they're available throughout all classrooms. So that's number one. Number two, what's very different is that every single student is screened very quickly and efficiently, not like a big monster smarter balanced assessment. I'm talking like quick 1-minute screeners to see which students might be falling behind and falling through the cracks. Those assessments are super low impact, very efficient, low cost. And what we do with those assessments is we say, here's the 20 or so percent of the kids who are very far behind, and we need to get them interventions very quickly and very early. In Portland, where I was also a school psychologist, we used to wait until kids didn't pass some big assessment later on to identify if they were really in need of specific and intentional supports. In a system like this, you push all that front loading and the screening and assessments very, very early in the system. And I would propose that we push them earlier in the system than even kindergarten, so that we know exactly which kids are where the gap is before kids even hit kindergarten, because there is a significant gap before kids even hit the kindergarten floor. So that's another advancement, is this use of very quick and research validated assessments. Research-based intervention materials are different, and teaming and database decision making, and again, not big standardized test data like you just spoke about, but smaller, more efficient formative assessments, the kind of formative assessments that are being promoted with our state association of educators. They use those smaller assessments to gear those research-based interventions to, and you progress monitor those students all along the way. So that's a very comprehensive view that when my mom was teaching, sounds like back when you were teaching, those are the advancements that I don't think were available at a system-wide level like we're talking about here.
Well, we'll talk later. We should talk later because...
Well, I tell you, I will personally take you to Templeton Elementary School, which is not necessarily the highest incomes, and I will take you to Durham and some of these others and show you exactly what they do in their reading programs.
Can I just tack one thing on to what Dan said, and that is you talked about the love of reading, and I think that is really critical. Just to state one obvious thing and then just expand quickly, that is to say that those kids who can't read don't like to. And we've seen this play out over and over again. And so you teach them the love of literature, but you also give them the skills to do it. And the combination of that usually will take kids forward. More importantly, I took some folks around to Bethel as an example this summer. One of the key components of this is to give kids extra time. So there's summer school where we know kids' skills tend to fall behind, as well as some extra time during the school year. And part of those summer programs, again, are with community-based organizations, and you're bringing in with early learning. So we're partnering with early learning to get those kids in early before they even get to kindergarten, running a really wonderful program that's fun and joyous and teaching them the love of reading and, you know, letters and all that kind of stuff. And you have their parents there as well. So you have a family engagement piece that is not only at school, but it's with communities and it's with their families, and that's how you teach the love of reading. It's not to sit down and drill and kill. It's to sit down and have a comprehensive picture like this where everybody has a part in it. And that could be singing to your kid. That could be, you know, going to the grocery store and doing all those things. There's a lot of ways, as you well know, to get to the love of reading.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
And I'm just really glad you just said that last part, because if you hadn't, I was going to ask you to.
Okay.
It was just, but basically, I think it's that sometimes the parents need help on knowing how to work with their kids, and especially if you're ELL or maybe just working too much. But so I really appreciate that comment, really identifying. We're not just talking about what happens in the building between, you know, 8 and 3 or whatever the time is.
Exactly.
It's that broader community involvement, commitment to the kids from the entire community and the families. And I think that's just a big difference. We don't just send kids off to school to hope something magical happens. We want to all be involved in working with them. So
that's the point exactly, and that's why it's called 3 to 3. We're really devoted to this whole effort as well, actually from when they're born, but we're talking about really from when they're 3 years old on up, working with communities, working with families, and working with schools. Anymore we can't do it alone in schools.
Well, and one thing also I've noticed, at least, you know, because I'm more familiar with Tiger Tualatin, and there has always been an emphasis in reading, and you go through and the resources that are put in personnel wide where there might be 3 kids with 1 reading aid, and then they'll move to others and move to others of the kids that are having trouble. And this is in kindergarten and first grade where they're working with these kids. It's the idea of buying books, it's the idea of all of this, just the real emphasis that they have on reading, and especially the one-on-one help that they have. And that's one thing I've always touted about this district, is that's where they put resources that are finite to make sure that the kids are up to grade level in reading, and so possibly they don't have to spend more money down the road with the literacy. I'll have a Member Plain and then Representative Hack. You had a question.
Okay. I think my question is just simply that I don't see that there's anything that you've said that I couldn't love, right? I mean, how can you not love cooperation, coordination, integration, and really making sure that you understand your goals, you understand your resources that you need, and you really try to bring up the standards or the targets on everything. So how could I not love any of that?
Mm-hmm.
I love it all, right? But the reality is that we have a limited amount of resources, so we have to make sure that we're balancing between experimentation, demonstrations, really having programs where we have coaches that come from somewhere and come down to target schools, and also just having, as the chair pointed out, actually enough folks that are there all the time, that they're there in the classroom, the aides are there one-on-one, one-on-3, that the volunteers are there, that the community, you know, folks are there, that we have to balance that. And so even though I'm not going to ask you this question right now, I'll say it out loud, and that is I always look to see on this Senate bill, where's the money going? And what's the balance look like? Because we have to, you know, it's great to have targeted programs. It's great to have grants that some people can write for better than others. But we've got to make sure we've got a balance so that all school districts, all children are having an opportunity to have the best kind of ratio of adult, teacher, and aide, and student to make anything that you've said today, which I love all of it, to make it work. So we have to balance that budget.
Hey, any other questions?
I just had a comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Comment.
Now
we need to move along.
I just wanted to compliment Mark on the work that you're doing, the wraparound services that you're providing, and the community partnerships that you've created, I think, for the high poverty schools is just commendable. So thank you for what you're doing, and thanks everybody for the work that you're doing. It's greatly appreciated, and money's always an issue. So I just, again, I'm going to make the plug that we've got to invest. And we've got to stay invested, and it starts with what you're doing. So thank you.
Thanks. Good. And it also is, I mean, the local libraries are you know, partnering with the schools, which are partnering with the family resource centers, which are doing all of this to try to get the kids at a much earlier age, working with some, at least in Washington County, some of the private daycare to go through and help them with literacy and projects and books to keep going. So I'm excited about it. That's going to come out in a long time.
For your time.
Thanks for
Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you all very much for being here. Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing. Is there any other testimony on this? Okay, if not, I close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 214 and open up an informational hearing on Senate Bill 217. Cindy Hunt, Modi. And the reason we're doing this, these are Senate bills that are in Senate rules right now, and so they'll go to our rules committee if they get through, and so we will not be able to hear them. So that's why we're giving you the information.
Okay. Chair Doherty, my name is Cindy Hunt, the Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Department of Education, and I actually have an update for you. The Senate Rules Committee adopted amendments into Senate Bill 217, the Dash 2 amendments, yesterday. With a unanimous vote, and sent the bill as amended down to Ways and Means. Okay. So today I'm here to just give you a high-level summary of Senate Bill 217 and how it interacts with the Department of Ed's budget a little bit. So Senate Bill 217 modifies three strategic investment programs that were originally adopted as part of House Bill 3232. And so you might hear that number a lot. That was in 2013, and it came through this committee. So those three programs were the Oregon Early Reading Program. As part of that is the Response to Intervention Program. And some of these early reading, it was a precursor to some of the 3-to-3 reading programs you just heard about at the prior panel. The Guidance and Support for Post-Secondary Aspirations Program, as part of that is money for students to take the AP and IB exams. Also, student mentoring was part of that program. And then finally, Connecting to the World of Work, which included STEM grants and also the Eastern Promise grants, which I'm sure some of you have heard about. So what the Dash 2 amendments specifically do is they modify the role of the OEIB. And so what they do is they say instead of the OEIB creating strategic investments, they're to make recommendations to the legislature about what those should be. The bill and the amendments still talk about the OEIB, the Oregon Education Investment Board, although there is another bill, also in the Senate, also came out of Senate rules yesterday, that abolishes the board and instead keeps the agency of the chief education officer. When those two bills move through the system, eventually this bill would also be changed to say the chief education officer in the place of the OEIB in this bill. So the other thing that this bill does is it modifies the purposes for which the monies can be expended and aligns the strategic investment substantive provisions to the budget and to the budget that has been recommended by Governor Brown. Now, having said that, there will probably be some other minor adjustments to this down in Ways and Means as our budget is worked. But a couple of things that were added are, for example, increasing the number of students who receive free lunches. You may recall that there was a carve-out from the state school fund around that, and I think this committee weighed in on that as well. So that's also included in this as a strategic investment, if you will. Reducing rates of chronic absenteeism for Native American students. That's also been mentioned as another strategic investment. And also increasing the number of students who receive general educational development certificates is another one. But there's also strategic investments that were funded this past biennium that are removed from this bill as because the recommendation is to no longer fund those. And those include things like some of the like the STEM lab schools, which was very specific, and there was, not as many applicants for those, and they weren't as successful as some of the other STEM programs that you'll be hearing about. And so with that, I am open to any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Ms. Hunt? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, anybody else like to give us an update on Senate Bill 217? If not, I close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 217 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 187A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 187A enacts the Oregon Student Information Protection Act, OSIPA, which the Attorney General came and spoke to us about. The committee's been asked to consider four amendments, all of which have been posted on all lists. the A4s, which clarified prohibitions around some of the retention of records and changed some of the technical language. The A5s, which create a consent option for disclosure of information covered in the measure. The A6s, which detail the appropriate use for recommendation engines, which some of the previous testimony has kind of discussed. And the A7s, which combine those previous three amendments into one amendment.
Okay. Okay, with this, I'd like to call up, and what we're going to be doing today is just hearing the amendments. We're not going to be moving it today. Okay, so Megan Schrader with TechNet. The first person to come up, and then we'll hear from the DOJ.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Megan Schrader. I'm the executive director of TechNet in the Northwest region. TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of information technology, internet media, green tech, venture finance, and other tech-related interests. Thank you so much for the opportunity today to speak to you about the amendments to Senate Bill 187. The technology industry is incredibly thankful for the great work that the Attorney General's office has put into this bill, and we thank them for working with us to that end. We too share the concern with the misuse of student data and understand the critical importance of protecting student privacy in the digital age. However, there are a few outstanding issues that remain of deep concern to the innovation economy and the ability to serve students both now and in the future. We have several proposed amendments to discuss. The first is the -4 amendment. It's really just a technical cleanup that does two main things. The first is that I would clarify that the bill only applies to students rather than the general public. And the second is that it permits an operator to retain account information while that information remains in control of the student, the parent, the school, or school district. For example, an operator has applications. Those applications may be either created by the operator or by another company that has a relationship with that operator. Many of you probably have smartphones that have applications on them. Those applications are often developed by third parties and not actually the phone manufacturer. So that's what we're talking about here. The legal counsel at our member companies, who are experts in this area of law, believe that there's language. This language is necessary to clarify that an application within the operator is able to operate, so a third-party application. It's our interpretation that the language in the current bill, the underlying bill, would only allow for applications actually owned by that operator in order to function properly. So the -5 amendments, those would allow for students to be able to choose what happens to their own data. Students would only be able to accept or decline when an operator gives them clear and conspicuous notice about what they would like to do with the data. This bill, underlying bill, is based on the no unless yes philosophy, and we want to be able to give students the option to say yes. The current draft completely denies the ability of a student to make a choice about what happens to their own data. This is actually antithetical to precedent set in Oregon about choice. It's in statute that a 15-year-old can make an independent medical, dental, and surgical choice, choices that impact their own health care without any sort of parental consent. We would like to see the same precedent reflected in this bill. The current language of the amendment indicates over 12 as that age of consent, but we would be willing to bump that up to the age of 15 in order to reflect the same precedent that's already set in Oregon statute about the ability to make decisions for oneself. Without this consent mechanism, if there is an opportunity in the future, something that's not currently offered by companies, there would be no mechanism for this opportunity to be offered to students. The only way to do that then would be to renegotiate the contract with the school or district over and over and over again, which could create a Christmas tree sort of contract situation. Further, while most bills typically regulate or seek to regulate a known harm, this bill, underlying bill, takes the opposite approach. And we think the amendment is critical to allow an escape valve for future technologies to be accounted for. The -6 amendments then permit the use of recommendation engines to recommend additional content or services related to educational, learning, or job opportunities. The recommendation could be in no way paid for by a third party. We've heard it discussed numerous times in this committee that Oregon's vision for education is to create a pre-kindergarten through grade 20 pipeline, an education system that aligns the K-12 system with colleges and universities and workforce training opportunities. Oregon's vision is that students in K-12 are prepared for and receiving opportunities beyond high school. The ability for a recommendation engine to flag for a student that they are eligible for a scholarship that applies to them based on their interest or other data collected is a critical connection in that pipeline. We understand that the Attorney General's office is concerned with distraction in the classroom and the ability for students to stay on task, but we feel like a notification about a potential scholarship or internship may be the only way a student can find out about those opportunities and those possibilities. Of course, students are able to use a search engine to find those sorts of internships and scholarships, but given the goal to give K-12 students, especially high school students, opportunities beyond high school, we don't see any harm in giving them a tailored information about opportunities that could apply to them. And just a reminder, these recommendations can't be based on any sort of a payment from a third party, only on an individual student's activities within that operator's service. We also don't feel comfortable limiting those recommendation engines to a K-12 context because the definition for K-12 is very difficult. When we think about, was the internet a normal K-12 function 10 years ago? It wasn't. Tablets and applications weren't used commonly even 5 years ago. What will happen in a year or in 5 years from now that will be regularly used in a K-12 situation and in schools that isn't used today? What about students who are working on a college level of activities or students who are taking college level courses while in high school? The K-12 definition doesn't work for them in many cases, and these are just a few limited examples. And just to note, in bills passed around the country this year, this function has been allowed. So we think this bill does a whole lot of good to protect student privacy. But without these amendments, the bill also attempts to regulate preemptively to prevent harms that haven't yet been identified. I think this is detrimental to innovation in many ways and places Oregon even further behind on the ability to provide the best educational opportunities possible. The light will shine very brightly on all components of this law that the body passes, and we know that the Attorney General will be vigilant in its enforcement. User trust is also a key component in order for technology companies to continue to operate with a robust user base, and those users are the only way that companies can continue to grow and to flourish. So there's actually very little to no incentive for a company to breach the trust and improperly use data when there's intense market competition for a very limited pool of users. I'd also say that there are many consumer protection laws in place under the FTC that if a consumer is getting an unfair bargain, they've got the ability to sue for deceptive trade practices, and they have in the past, and they've also been awarded monetary awards if they felt like their data was improperly disclosed even after giving consent for that disclosure. So I'd close by saying this bill creates many wonderful new protections for student data privacy, and we'll see many benefits from it in the future. But it also codifies many things that have not been codified before, and we want to ensure that the path to innovation is not impeded by codifying what we don't know to be an actual harm. So the amendments are very critical to allow for innovation and the evolution of technology in the classroom, and they allow for that innovation with a very clear box of parameters around how it can happen. So we're hopeful that you'll consider our amendments and be happy to help answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Megan? Representative McLean.
She was a college debater, and her speech coach would have been proud. you have your facts down absolutely perfectly, and you're persuasive, and we talked in my office. And so two questions still. Number one, how many of those other states embrace these three amendments? I believe there was one amendment that a few of them did not embrace.
Representative Doherty and Representative McLean, thank you for the kind comments. The debate was very a great experience in my educational experience. But so there have been 7 states that have passed similar student data privacy bills. They all vary quite differently, but 6 of those 7 mm-hmm. have allowed for recommendation engines mm-hmm. and the ability to consent. The Dash 4 amendment is really just sort of technical in. So it's been included in most of them, but I'm not absolutely sure.
One final question. Mm-hmm. You had a meeting yesterday, so how did it go with the Attorney General?
We did have a meeting, and we have some disagreements. We're willing to talk more about mm-hmm. how we can come to a place, but these amendments as drafted and really, as I explained, we're willing to talk about upping that age of consent, but we really feel like it's necessary to protect innovation in the future and account for technologies that that we don't know about right now. It's really hard. I don't think we should be regulating things we don't know about yet.
And we'll be hearing from the DOJ after okay, this.
Kim, just that last question, because that was important. That was a good argument that you made, and that was the idea that, there's technology coming, and we don't know. But every time there's been new technology, haven't you gone back and contracted that new technology because it was a different, forum or a different type or a different opportunity or a different platform? I mean, aren't contracts renewed on a regular basis with new technology?
Sure. Yeah, I think I understand the question. What we want is that a valve that allows us to be able to use data in ways that we don't even know how they could be used yet. And we're certainly willing, if there are known harms that arise after this bill is passed, we're willing to come back to the table and talk about how to fix those,
okay.
but really hesitant to want to regulate something that we don't know to be an actual harm yet.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hackman, and we have still lots of things to do, so let's keep our questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions without comments. How's that? Thank you.
Oh, I just wanted one little.
I'm no fun.
I just wanted just one little. I promise, and I'm done. I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you have done, and I'm supportive with the amendments, and I know that Representative Frederick has done a lot of work on this privacy, and he had a bill, and I was sad to see that his bill didn't come through, and so I'm supportive of it because of the work that he's done, and so long as we can get these amendments worked out. The age 15 thing, we did a bill recently that even got rid of that. We don't have to notify parents at any age, and so I don't know that that should even be an issue. I think your age 12 is fine. Kids have their phones. They can choose to use an app anytime they want to. And we've got kids with phones at age 5. So I don't see an issue there, but I'm supportive of the amendment. So I just wanted to say thank you for all the hard work you've done and give some, kudos to Rep. Frederick for working so hard on all of this, too. So.
Okay. Representative Reardon, did you have a question?
I was personally glad to see the you kind of elevated the age level. We talked about that a little bit. Could you elaborate on third parties' use of data? Because I understand there's one engine is going to be going out to somebody else's search engine, and I would assume, because not one company holds all the information in the world, so they have to share in some way. Could you say it better than I am?
Sure. Representative Doherty, Representative Reardon, thank you for the question. So a third-party application would be one that so there are large companies that would contract with a school or a district, and then a third party would offer, a math tutoring application within that. And I can't speak to the exact, specifics of how those contracts look, but they would be regulated then by that operator, not regulated, but they would work with the operator who has the contract with the school or district. So
may I clarify that question?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So I think the question is there the ownership, the control of the student information during this process? Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
I believe that would stay with the operator.
who has the contract with the school or district, but we may want to get some clarification from the DOJ on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Frederick?
And I would ask that to a great deal of clarification. My concern is that that information would end up being used by a third party that the operator would have no control over. There would be information about the student that would be passed along to the, let's say you have a math program that is a separate program, and how much information about what that student has done with that math program, where they are, who they're, what else they have done, is going to be passed along to a third party. That's just a concern because, you know, there's a reason why data mining is important. It works well. It is a commercial benefit, and I am concerned about that. I can remain concerned about that, and it's something that within the amendments I don't think we've addressed, quite frankly.
Representative Doherty, Representative Frederick, I believe that it wouldn't be some sort of random third-party application. It would be one that the student is already engaged in using. So I don't think that data mining would be a possibility under any of the amendments. It would be an application already that the student has engaged with that could use any of the data.
There's a section of the amendments that I read that we talked about this yesterday, and I didn't see any real change. Am I missing something has there been change? I see somebody saying things in the back of the room there saying, yes, we had something done, but I'm still trying to search to figure out where that change is.
I think so. I'll take a look coming. At
that. It's coming.
Yes.
Okay.
That concern that you brought up in a meeting yesterday is being clarified and being taken out. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other quick questions? Okay. Megan, thank you very much. Okay. I'd like to bring up Aaron Knott and Cheryl Heimstra from the DOJ. And then we have David Rodenfield, Ben Tate, and Peter Tromba also to speak.
Can you bring Ben with us?
You can bring whoever you want. Ben.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. And I put us down as opposed to the amendments. We're not opposed to every last word, but there are some issues that we wanted to touch on. And first of all, I also would like to extend heartfelt thanks to our partners in industry. We have been working with TechNet and the organizations represented by TechNet for months. And what you see before you with the amendments are the last points of contention in what has otherwise been a long consensus product. But there are a few points that remain. So in understanding our point of view on the amendments, there's an important distinction you have to draw between the definition that's in the bill now of K through 12 purposes and the definition that's being offered up in both the A5 and A6 amendments. And Representative McClain's earlier comment about wanting, you know, technology changes, the needs of classroom change. Our definition of K through 12 purposes, which you can find in Section 2.2b, which is at page 2, line 15 of the AA Gross Bill, essentially says purposes done by and for the benefit of the school. And more specifically, those are purposes that are directed by or customarily take place at the direction of a kindergarten through grade 12 school, teacher, school district, or education service district, aid in the administration of school activities, or are primarily for the use and benefit of the school. Now, that example earlier of the Internet is new. I think 10 years ago, nobody conceived it would be used in the way it's being used now. But does that fit within the existing definition? Does it aid in the administration of school activities? Is it primarily for the use or benefit of the school when employed in the classroom? Our argument would be that it is. This definition was crafted deliberately to focus on the classroom and to be driven by the needs of the school. Now, what's coming in the amendments, and this is what we've struggled a bit with, and this is in both the A5 and A6s, is instead a relation to educational job or learning opportunities. Now, I can tell you I'm not entirely sure what those things mean. They're not otherwise defined in the amendment, and I wasn't able to find any other references in statute. So a learning opportunity, for example. And as I've mentioned to a few of you, you know, we've back to my generation, There was a very cool game in schools having to do with the Oregon Trail. This is how I learned what dysentery was and why wagons have tongues and stuff like that. And it clearly stuck with me. And that kind of a learning tool still exists and is in wide deployment, only now it's on the phone, now it's on the computer. So if I was the generator of that sort of a product, well, I think that would be a learning opportunity. Now, so that would put me under the purview of the bill. I'm a software company. I'm something else. So looking through the amendments through that lens, I think, is informative. And to talk a little bit about, say, how the A5 would work. The A5 allows a student or a parent to opt out upon clear and conspicuous consent. And that leads to them being permitted to submit otherwise protected data for the purpose of these educational job or learning opportunities. So let's unpack that a little bit. What the amendment actually exempts is four things. First of all, there's a prohibition against engaging in targeted advertising on the operator, meaning the school provider's website, service, or application. There's also a prohibition against marketing on any other website, meaning the information that you take away in school can't haunt you as you go from website to website. You can't be tracked externally. Sub D, that information cannot presently be sold by the recipient of the information. And sub E, it can't otherwise be disclosed except under very narrow circumstances. Now, the Dash A5s, as they are currently written, do away with all of those protections, which means if I was, say, this vendor of an Oregon Trail app. Now, I'm not an operator for the purposes of 187. That's not my business. I'm not contracted with the school. But I am a learning or educational opportunity. And I come into possession of this student data via the amendments that have been submitted. None of these restrictions apply to me. And it's quite clear from the fact that I am specifically exempted from D that I can sell that student's data. I can engage in commerce based on that student's data. And I believe my reading of the amendments mean that a third party who, once they receive this student data, can go ahead and sell and resell it if they want to. The protections of 187 would no longer apply to them. Now, I'm not positive that that is the intention of the proponents of the amendment, but I think that vulnerability exists the way it's written right now. A few other small points to unpack. We made a number, as I said earlier, of concessions in the first chamber that were hard worked over. But one thing we said we were very uncomfortable with as the Department of Justice was the idea of consent. And this notice of what is clear and conspicuous notice of consent. We asked industry. We said, well, how does this work? Give us a sense operationally of what this would look like. I've attached the only response I've received, which is a pop-up. And it looks like it's a snapshot taken from a phone. And it refers to Disney World, and it says, will you allow Disney World to access your location while you use this app? And then either don't allow or allow. Now, if this is the level of detail we're talking about when a student is supposed to be making a decision about whether or not their student data will be used, I question whether it's adequate. What's missing from this is any sense of what you're, in this case, location, but student data would be used for. How much of your student data? For how long will your student data be used? Would this partner have the ability to share your student data? But that triggers another problem. Usually this information is expressed with privacy policies, those 47-page documents that I know that none of us read. And I submit that a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 15-year-old won't read them either. The ACLU did a study that suggested that a person with a normal college education would require 500 hours to get through every privacy policy they're exposed to in a given year. A privacy research organization did a great study a little while ago where they embedded something in their privacy policy that says, if you click here, you are forfeiting your firstborn son or firstborn child. I think they called that the Herod Clause. And you know what? It got almost 100% click-through. And this is a point of concern for us, not just with students, especially 15-year-olds. I really challenge the committee as to their ability to parse that level of detail when adults struggle with it, but also with parents. parents should have absolute control over their students' education, but that control must be meaningful. Here is my concern. When you register your son or daughter for middle school or high school, you are already looking at a very long bundle of paperwork from cover to cover. And it is my concern that the opt-out will be buried somewhere in that 47-page dense document. And I don't think, at least it's not the position of the Department of Justice, that a parent already exhausted by the bureaucracy to which they're being exposed to register their child in the first place will reliably appreciate the significance of a waiver that, at least as written now, would allow data collected in the classroom to be subsequently sold. So this is mostly targeted at the opt-out, obviously. The concern about recommendations and engines from the perspective of the Department of Justice is more, and again, this goes back to that K through 12 definition, we think you can do it now. You just have to do it for the purposes of the classroom, for the purposes of the school, not these external, undefined learning opportunities or educational experiences. But I'll let other partners speak mostly to that amendment. The last comment I would make is about the A4s. We, at industry's behest, introduced, as part of a larger amendment, a modification in the first chamber to Senate Bill 187 that was specifically designed to let operators amass a profile, which is a bit of what the A4s get at. Now, the reason we did that is because we received, I think, the very good feedback that, hey, we don't want to take control of this data so far away from students and parents that they can't use it to apply to college, they can't use it to apply to jobs. We don't want to deprive them of control of their data. So we put in some language, which we thought was the solution. So we're a little bit, surprised to hear that the expansion is necessary. What we put in permits the amassing of a control for K through 12 purposes, but then there's a second provision, and this is at line 25 and 26 of the A. Engrost bill, page 4, allowing a student or parent the ability to download, transfer, export, or otherwise save or maintain their data. And what we had in mind there was to give students and parents that agency. So as they're going forward, they can capture what they need and use it how they will. We remain committed to working with our industry partners, though it's our suspicion that there are a few points of perhaps philosophical difference here. I know that AAG Heemstra has some remarks she'd like to make, and then we're open for questions.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, and just wanted to comment on a few of the points made by industry before. They were asking for safety valves. Now, in the California bill in which this legislation is based, there are some safety valves already in the bill. First of all, there's innovation allowed when companies are using de-identified and aggregated student data. That's already in the bill. Also in the bill is operators are allowed to use any information, even the covered sensitive student information, for customized and adaptive learning purposes. We wanted to make sure that innovation would still be allowed, and we think that the balance here with the language that's already in the bill gets to that point. The Department of Justice's standpoint, as you've heard, is that the amendments are just allowing a lot more than what is necessary to allow for that innovation. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Ben Tate. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Department of Education. My compatriots have talked about the process and some of the language definitions. I'd like to just make a few points about the learning impact of some of these. The biggest concern, I think, question that I still have around A5 and the opt-out is, what is the additional gain that school districts and students will see from allowing this? I think what we have heard is the potential of future opportunities. But I would question putting that in now when we don't know what those future opportunities are going to be. I think if I use mobile devices as a great example, 5 years ago, we had no idea of the impact that those things would have in the classroom. We could not anticipate that. I think that as that has become apparent, it has then been the responsibility of those schools and districts to adapt their policies to take full advantage. And I think at that time, should another innovation happen, which it will, I think we just fully anticipate that technology will continue to grow, that at that time we should look if it has posed problems with that bill, we should look at it at that moment. I worry that inserting this now, when there isn't a clear additional educational benefit, would introduce problems, as the DOJ has pointed out. My concern with Dash 6 is the vagueness in terms of allowing that definition. I totally agree for content purposes that the applications should be allowed to recommend additional content. We should not restrict that. That's one of the key selling points for districts in utilizing these tools, is that they're able to open the doors for students to access materials they would not otherwise have connection to, or would not understand, or would not be available to them. The concern is when we insert what I call non-learning opportunities, so specifically job opportunities, scholarship opportunities, those things definitely should happen in the context of the district, but my question is whether they should happen through the mechanism of a learning app. There are applications that are specifically designed to handle scholarships in colleges, and my question would be, couldn't we utilize those things and have more focused conversations there versus melding a classroom learning activity while then inserting advertisements about scholarships and colleges and muddling the two? I would say that it would be better to keep those distinct so we could take full advantage of the tools in both of those arenas. I think as a general comment, the other thing that I would say is what I would like to see additionally in the amendment, in some of these amendments, is to define within the context of the contract or agreement that the district has made with the vendor. The language that has been inserted specifically in A4 and a little bit when we talk about recommendation engines, I think we need to make sure that we're thinking of it in that context, that whatever the district has specifically contracted or purchased, that is the intent of this tool, and we should make sure that any exception or anything we're allowing in terms of data collection and data use remains within that context. There is a lot of value. The districts would tell you there's a ton of value in these tools being able to amass and utilize this data within that context. I think districts would not want that to start to spread beyond what they had originally intended. Now, if that means that they do have to go back and renegotiate that contract, I think that is the right move, so districts can make informed choices and teachers can make informed choices about the content and tools that they're providing to the students.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Do we have any questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to have a few. Ben, I've got a couple questions for you first. Are you aware of the opt-out provision that Salem-Keizer uses for Google?
Yes.
How does that work?
So Google Apps for Education, it is actually part of a statewide contract that the Department of Education negotiated. The opt-out is not in terms of data security, but it's in terms of utilizing the service at all. So what all school districts do that would like to sign up for this service, then they give the parents that ability to opt out if the parents have security. It's largely security and privacy concerns about the tool, even within the context of the contract, which has additional security provisions included in it, so that Google has said they won't sell the data, they won't advertise to
children.
And
that's been working good?
Yes.
So is there a reason why, then, that we couldn't use the consent that we're talking about in these amendments? Because there's a huge difference between being able to opt out and opt in. I'm a parent of student in Salem-Keizer, and I get those forms at registration. It's really not a big deal. And so I'd like to see us keep this amendment and just include that in with that. And as you said, it's working.
I think the key distinction is that it's the opting out of the using of the tool at all versus using the tool and opting out of the security provisions laid here. The provisions in the Google contract cover a lot of what is already covered here. So by opting, by allowing the parents to use that, we're not exposing those students to any additional risk. Parents that choose to opt out of Google are typically those parents that are still concerned about that security risk and don't want to expose their students. I think by allowing, so it's, it, to me it flips it, because by allowing an opt-out.
If we want to, like you said, give parents the control, that's how you do that, by saying you have the choice to opt out. If you're saying you have the choice, we're taking the choice away from them then by saying you have to opt in. Why not give our kids every opportunity that we can give them in technology, which we're doing there, and it's working great. My other question is also to you, when you talked about the scholarships, while I understand that you're saying that we should probably keep kind of status quo with how kids find scholarships, I can tell you as a parent of two who are, one is already in college and one's going, obtaining information about scholarships is extremely difficult for kids. If you don't have a really proactive parent that can help them search and find scholarships and you depend solely on your school counseling department, one, they don't have time to do that work. Two, there's very little that they typically do post. So are you truly telling me that we should stay status quo when we have an opportunity to provide our children with the means of getting every opportunity that they could possibly have at their fingertips for scholarships, when our goal is, am I right, 40-40-20?
Mm-hmm. It's a fair point. I would not say that my comments are intended to indicate that we should stay status quo. My question is whether opening those opportunities through that mechanism is the best way to do it.
What mechanism would you recommend if it's not technology?
Definitely technology, but what I would say is if that ability already exists for them to take some information from the students and provide those recommendations, then let's have a specific application that does that, that the school would then focus and utilize it in a focused manner. My concern is that doing it in the context of an advertisement that pops up while they're focused on a learning opportunity would not get the full range of students. You're not going to get everybody that's going to see that and write it down and respond to it. And I think,
what would your solution be? In what arena would it be that we could do that? Okay, I just have a couple more and I'll be done. Sorry, I should have asked if I could do that. I apologize.
So if
we
that,
can take that off record.
Sure.
Let's take that question off record. Can I have
very quickly?
And that would be to these folks. You talked about the third party selling. If you look at page 2, line 45, it addresses the third-party selling, and the Amendment D will be removed, is my understanding. So third-party selling would not be an issue, is my understanding. So I just want to make sure that I – do you understand it that way?
Chair Doherty, Representative Heck, the amendments that the Department of Justice has are the A4, the A5, the A6, and then the A7. At this point, all contain selling. So any additional amendments, I'm not aware of.
Okay. Again, page 2, line 45 addresses third-party selling.
Chair Doherty, Representative Heck, that's correct. Looking at 187A5, nothing after line 33, insert nothing in subsection 3, little a, and then big A, big B, big D, or big E in this section shall be construed to prohibit the use or disclosure upon a waiver. Sub D in that section of the amendment is sell a student's information, including covered information. It is my read that the A5s, the way they are written now, and the A7s permit the selling of data.
Okay. That is being taken care of, though. So I just want to make sure that we have that on the record, that they're taking care of that.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, Representative, quickly, please.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions and comments, please.
Yeah, I don't really care who answers this, but is it safe to conclude that this was a business arrangement made between vendors and school districts that started out mutually beneficial to both, and over time, because of the growth in technology, has changed to the point where the school districts are no longer comfortable with that business relationship? Is that, can we say that?
we're not a business that helps.
So, Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, I think the problem is that the technology has so quickly outpaced the policy that I don't know that I would characterize it that school districts have an active distrust in the relationship, but I think when a lot of these contracts were originally signed, the technology grew in such a quick way that people did not anticipate how that data specifically that's being collected on the students could be used. And there, you know, you hear the horror stories about it. And so I think not that we should just knee-jerk react, but I think there needs to be some thoughtful consideration about how the technology is used to make sure that we provide the appropriate safeguards so that we protect our students in the educational environment.
Only one brief follow-up, then. When these contracts are due to be renegotiated, can it be taken care of by the individual districts at that time?
Yes, it can.
Okay.
Yes, it can.
Okay. Representative McLean.
I just had two questions because I got confused in that dialogue there. My understanding was it was the definition in the amendments that are not your amendments, but the definition of the amendments that we have in front of us, that the definition of job or learning opportunity versus the K through 12 system, you know, to their benefit, that targeted ads, marketing, can sell the actual data or disclose data were the things that we were losing control over with those amendments. Is that what I heard you say?
Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, that's correct. And if there are more amendments coming that remove D, what would remain then would be sub A, upon a waiver, would be sub A that the recipient of the data could engage in targeted advertising on the operator site or service, that means the EdTech vendor, B, target advertising on any other site, service, or application when the targeting of the advertising is based on information acquired from the school. Okay. So that means as that student is sort of out in the larger world, they could be targeted based on the data acquired from the school. And then E is general prohibition against disclosure. So what this does now is give you reasons why you can make the disclosure and in furtherance of K through 12 purposes, to improve the website itself, for legal compliance reasons, some judicial process. So the waiver of sub E then would say you can disclose that information, and I'm not sure that there are any sideboards on your ability to disclose it.
Okay, I appreciate that. And then the other question on this dialogue was that you said basically school districts are buying learning applications, and that your goal or your stance from the Department of Ed was basically that if you're buying an application, then that's what the teacher and the student should be doing in the classroom. Shouldn't be extra stuff. And that they're stopping to look at a scholarship, or they're stopping to look at something that comes up and asks if they want to do this, that, or the other thing. It should be the application of their learning math. They've got a math activity. They've got a reading opportunity that helps with making exciting Macbeth or whatever it is. So that's what you were saying. You weren't saying you were against other things. You were saying you were for focused classrooms.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other quick questions?
I just
okay.
I'm sorry.
Because we still have two more people to speak.
I just wanted to say thank you for the work. But I do think that we need to be very careful in what we're doing, because we do not want to take away any opportunity that we have for students, technology-wise. And it's been said that, you know, 10 years ago we didn't think Google would be giving us the opportunities that we had today. And the last thing that we want to see Oregon students have is a disadvantage, given the fact that we're 49th. And so I want to see every Oregon student have the opportunity that they can by any means. And I don't think that there's a company out there that's going to abuse its users. That's how they survive. And I think school districts are smart enough to negotiate contracts. And I know that ODE has been very diligent in how they've handled Google. As a parent, and I've had both kids go through schools all through the last 10 years, I have been very happy with how they've handled that. And I certainly would hope that we would move forward in a like fashion, because it's worked. And I think we can do that. So okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have Dave Rosenfeld and Peter Tromba. and then Megan, I'll give you 2 minutes at the end. That's going to be it because we still have 4 things to go through in 15 minutes. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, Executive Director of Osperg, the Consumer Group. Osperg is opposed to the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments, largely for the rationale that was just laid out by the Department of Justice, and I don't obviously want to repeat that here. What I do want to lay out is, for us, what the core principle is that we're using to evaluate these amendments and encourage you to use that. I should say first, we don't see any intrinsic problem with schools contracting with a private company to enhance the educational experience as discussed here. The thrust of the bill is entirely appropriate and good, number one. Number two, when it comes to the two things at issue here, which is the disclosure of personal information by the student or the educational content that's being put before the student, we think that when we're in this kind of business relationship, that it would behoove us and the public interest to keep the line really, really bright. And by that, what I mean is that when you're on school time, we're assuming that the school is in the driver's seat. The school is in the driver's seat. And I'm speaking both as a consumer advocate and as a parent of two. When you're in that context on school time, you're assigning a different level of trust for the information that's being thrown at you and by the requests that are being made by you than if you were in the private marketplace. It's two different kinds of mentalities that a person has, and there's plenty of behavioral research that confirms this, and you heard some of that by the Department of Justice. So as a result, it's very likely, let's just put it that way, that if we let these amendments go through, you're going to have a lot of instances, not categorically one way or the other, but more than a few instances, and perhaps quite a lot, where parents or students are going to get either request for the consent request, or they're going to see a recommendation of some form or another, and they're going to mistake that request in some way, or that information is originating from the school, not from a private vendor. They're going to make that mistake, and I'm just saying I feel very confident that that's going to happen with quite a lot of people. And as a result, they're going to make that mistake, they're going to assign a different level of trust, and then they're going to make potentially a different decision and act on the request or the information put before them than they might make if they were, you know, if it was the opposite. And that's a problem. And as a result, we would be saying better to be cautious and just draw a bright line. Nothing stops. Let's let the school decide what educational content goes before the student. Let's let the school be the one that's asking the parent and making the request for information. And let's let the school also continue to have a business relationship with vendors on their own terms. And nothing stops parents and students from using the private market, the web, to supplement their educational experience. We want that. We obviously know that that's important. And the two, let them exist separately so people can make decisions in the context with which those decisions are appropriate. And so that's all we'll add.
Okay, thank you. Peter?
For the record, Peter Tromba, Policy and Research Director for the OEIB. And I just had two things to say, similar ideas, maybe lenses with which to look at these issues as they come up and future amendments come through. One of which is that Representative Frederick and the OEIB convened and Representative Springer as well, convened a couple of task force meetings about this particular issue. And Senate Bill 187 is an outgrowth of specific recommendations and discussion that happened within that context. And as such, OEIB is a strong proponent of this measure. However, the amendments are of particular concern, and I wanted to address why. And it's germane given the discussion that came up just before with DOJ and ODE. We identified at the work group the fact that the contracts that districts sign with vendors are tricky, and that in a large school district like the one I worked for in Eugene, you're able to send it to your purchasing, maybe your attorney, and maybe someone else to really scrutinize the contract. Not unlike the scrutiny that's going on right now with DOJ, where every single word is being looked at and things are being thought through, except we're doing it at a state level at a much higher level of rigor. However, in many small school districts or mid-sized school districts, there's no such resource to do that level of vetting of a contract. So in good faith, both sides try to come to an agreement which is beneficial to both parties. And in most cases, the wide majority of cases, everybody is working in good faith and there aren't any problems. However, the few times where there are problems are the things that we heard about in the committee. The times where the school district signed something or the principal did that they didn't quite realize was allowing information to go out, and we heard about it. And what we were told unequivocally by many members who represented all kinds of interests to the state was, provide a default as a state that any subsequent contract could fall back on that provides that level of security to the parents throughout Oregon that are not dependent upon the sophistication of the individual school districts. Ability to read contracts. And that's what Senate Bill 187 is. It's a default. And so the question is, as we haggle over individual amendments here that maybe open up or close up little windows, are we thinking of it as a default, or are we thinking of it as sort of a best case? And I think I hear this idea of scholarships being offered by third parties or first party vendors, and it'd be great if that was the main content that's going to be coming across these applications, more ways to get to college. That would be fantastic. The fact is that's not going to be what pops up most frequently in all cases. It's going to be other services or things that come up in the middle of a classroom that may or may not be as germane as a scholarship offer is. And just consider that in the default case, we probably want their learning process to be uninterrupted. Second, I was a computer programmer. I worked in the industry, big believer in the internet. Think targeted one-line ads are a fantastic way for companies to be able to provide services to all of us, and they're fantastic. I've also been a middle school teacher, middle school principal, and I know what distractions the learning environment really looks like. Right now, it's 80 degrees outside, and teachers are with middle school kids, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids, trying to get across really important ideas in the spring. And I can tell you that a sound from one student in the classroom that someone misinterprets as some other kind of a sound, or someone walking by, or any of a million Anything. Other things distracts all 37 of the kids in that classroom.
A spider.
And so we have to consider the real life of the student and the real potential for anything, even if it's tremendously beneficial. It's a free scholarship to Harvard. Click here. At the moment, when we're trying to actually study algebraic relationships, that's a distraction that we can't permit. And so when we envision the learning environment and we're trying to give teachers the ability to control it as much as possible for the students' benefit, I think we need to think about the recommendation engine as a whiz-bang tool that can happen at home, many other contexts, but not within the purview of the school. So the OEIB is against Amendment 4, 5, and 6. Thank you very much.
Any quick questions? Okay, thank you very much. Megan wanted to come up. It's got to be real quick, so we've got to get through 8:20 before we leave today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to clarify a couple of things. I just wanted to make a couple of
very
important
clarifications. You could identify yourself again for the record.
Yes, Megan Schrader, Executive Director at TechNet, the Northwest region. First of all, we made it very clear in our meeting yesterday with the Department of Justice that that Dash 5 amendment, that reference to D that allows information to be sold, will be taken out. The amendment has already been made requested to LC. I copied you on that today. And thank you, Representative Frederick, to you and your lovely assistant, Sue, for catching that drafting error. It's 100% a drafting error that we made clear will be taken out. So student information will not be allowed to be sold under this bill. That will not be in the amendment. Second, I wanted to clear up a misrepresentation from one of the previous speakers. The Dash 5 amendment on consent is an opt-in to disclosure of information. It is not an opt-out, and that is just 100% how it will work. Clear and conspicuous notice, and we've got five examples to show you that that Disney World example that was sent around earlier was actually rescinded a few months ago from what was sent over to the AG's office. We've got actually a really great one here. It says, want colleges to discover you? For colleges and other programs to find you, we will share some of the information you provide. Yes, and so there's two options. Yes, share the information I provide with colleges looking to discover me, or no, I do not wish to share my information with colleges that may be interested in me. So that's an example of clear and conspicuous consent that we think is pretty obvious. So the other thing I just wanted to make very clear, no student data will be sold under any of these amendments. So if there's any additional questions, be happy to clarify. But thank you for the opportunity to clear some of that up.
Thank you very much. Okay, those are all the people we had signed up. And so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 187A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 820A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 820A allows public charter schools to implement weighted lotteries for historically underserved students. It defines historically underserved students. The committee has been asked to consider two amendments, both of which are on OLIS. The A6 amendment, which sunset the authorization for weighted lotteries in the 2019-20 school year, and mandate review of the implementation of the weighted lotteries prior to the sunset, and the dash A7s, which sunset the authorization in 2021, school year 2020-2021, mandates that same review prior to sunset, and changes the consideration for a combination of factors to a consideration of a combination of two or more factors.
Okay. Representative Frederick, were you going to speak on that?
Yes, briefly. One of the concerns that I have is, quite frankly, in talking with some of the legal folks regarding the consideration of more than just one factor. The concern is that in the legal the legal folks that I've talked with have said that if you are just using one factor, say, for instance, race, that could be, frankly, unconstitutional and illegal. So the idea of making sure that we have at least two factors involved in any decision would be good. And then finally, as I said when we first brought this up, I want to make sure that we understand just what is taking place as far as these decisions are being made regarding the charter schools, these public charter schools. Are we seeing a pattern of only certain folks being chosen for the charter schools in a way that is detrimental to the general public good? So I wanted to have at least some report coming back on the implementation of these weighted factors, and have that now. There are two. You notice that there are two times. One is a 5-year time, and the other one is a 6. One is a 6-year time, and one is a 4-year time, as I recall.
There are two amendments.
Two amendments.
He was just talking about the one amendment to make sure that the way it was currently drafted, if you just use one factor, that could be considered unconstitutional. So there may be a couple of factors with the draw, and then the other amendment deals with.
The other amendment deals with the implementation of this particular effort and the timing on having a report come back to let us know just how we're doing.
Right. And then there's also an amendment that, or did he just talk about that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the A6s and A7s are largely identical. The big difference between the two is the 2019-2020 school year versus the 2020-21 school year. And
so it's a five-year versus a four-year. That's what it is. So we wanted to get those amendments out on 8/20. Neither of these, we're going to be working these next Wednesday, and so it gives you time to look over them. But are there any questions about the amendments that we have? And we had no one signed up to talk about 8/20A. So is there anyone out there?
Okay.
So
did you see?
Okay, can you do it like in a minute and a half?
Actually, I would love to give more time to Hannah.
We have to be out of here at quarter till. So,
I just, Karin Hikas, just wanted to say for the record that the bill as drafted.
Identify yourself, please.
Karin Hikas.
Okay, thank you.
The bill as drafted would not allow charter schools to use one criteria for weighted lottery.
Correct.
Just want to say that because I've heard it said several times already that the bill as written would allow that.
No.
We worked very hard to make sure that it would not and could not.
Yep.
So we already have the language that says a combination of. I think saying two or more makes it clear. Fine. doesn't change the substance. Just wanted to say that.
Okay, fine.
We appreciate
you.
It.
And I just want this to make sure that you understand. I want this to be less likely to be ruled unconstitutional. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not the court, so I don't know how it will come out. But I want to. I'm trying to make it as easy, the best way we can to be as successful. So
that's, I appreciate that, and that's, you know, we have a memo from your legislative council saying that the 820A is constitutional.
Well, they're saying so. That they're less likely, but I want to try to make the next step so that we can work on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Okay, with that, I close public hearing on Senate Bill 820A, and why don't we try to get the other two done? We'll make.
And I guess
the next we'll make the next committee wait. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 216A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 216A modifies the network of quality teaching and learning. The committee has been asked to consider the dash A2s.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 216A, dated May 15th, 2015.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves to adopt the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 216A, dated May 15th, 2015. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to declare a potential conflict. It's probably overkill, but since I do work with grants and school districts.
Okay.
Just in case.
And with the committee, does she have to have, you have to let the clerk's office know that
I'll
in writing?
With a clerk's office.
Three-page letter minimum.
Pardon?
Three-page letter minimum.
Single space.
Yes. Yeah. A blood sample and
double space.
Okay. Is there any other discussion? Is there any objection? Okay. If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 2016A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Fredericks moves Senate Bill 216A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Hatt.
Aye.
Representative Klein.
Aye.
Representative Paluzzo.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And I close the works.
We need a carrier.
Pardon? Does somebody want to carry this? Going once, going twice. Representative McLean will carry it. Okay, thank you very much. With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 216A and open up a work session on Senate Bill 709A.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 709 makes modifications to interdistrict transfers. The committee has been asked to consider the dash A3 amendments, which offer language to allow outgoing students the same priorities as are offered to incoming students under the measure.
Okay.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt those dash A3 amendments to Senate Bill 709A, dated May 15th, 2015.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves to adopt the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 309A, dated May 15th. 709A, dated May 15th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Okay. If not, is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 709A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 709A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Hatt.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Paluzzo.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye.
Okay, with that, the motion passes. Do we have a carrier?
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Paluzzo. Okay, with it. Do I have to carry anything on? Okay, with that, meeting's adjourned. Meeting's adjourned. Okay, with that,